You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 358, our 43rd Q&A. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, what's going on?
2021 is here, Trey.
Yeah, hopefully
it's... What can we say? On the calendar, we're just a few days shy now of it being a year since we moved. So on the one hand, it's gone by pretty quickly, but it's just, man, I'm glad to have 2020 in the rearview mirror.
Yeah,
for all sorts of reasons, obviously.
Well, not only that, 1 year, from y'all moving, but it's been 6 years, Mike, for the podcast. How crazy is that?
That is pretty crazy.
6 years.
Yeah,
over half a decade.
Gosh. Right. That is over half a decade. I saw what you did there.
Yeah. I don't know how I feel. We're getting old.
Some math that didn't. Yeah. But, so you're going to relate it to our age. Okay.
Well, I don't know.
That's
fair. I don't know how I feel about this. It's just, 6 years is a big number.
Well, you can look at it. I mean, we're going into the seventh year. So what should we do with that? Is that like the number of perfection and completion, or is it like the 7 year tribulation, or?
Well, we are.
What do we do with that?
I don't know. We are in Revelation.
Yeah.
Maybe we should go with that way.
You see that you threw me a softball there, because it's like, yeah, we're in the book of Revelation, and you will not find in the book of Revelation, just like you won't find anywhere else in the New Testament, the number seven.
What?
In the same verse. Conspiracy. As tribulation.
Conspiracy.
Didn't do. Yeah. It's just one of those things we can tweak prophecy systems again. Everyone assuming the 70th week of Daniel is the tribulation, even though no verse actually says that. I mean, it could be right, but could also be quite wrong.
Yeah.
So thanks for that, Trey. Yeah, thanks for that softball that I...
Speaking of conspiracies, I forgot to ask you, but last month, did you hear about that former Israeli space security chief talking about aliens?
Yeah,
I did. What's your thoughts on that?
Do you want my cynical thoughts or my more serious thoughts?
I want both.
Okay. Well, my cynical thought is, he's old, he has a book to sell, and probably needs money to put his grandkids through college. Okay. My more serious thoughts is, if he is of sound mind, I'm betting that he has run across data and, maybe anecdotes, within government documents and stuff. Kind of like Gary McKinnon found. He's the UK hacker that hacked into the Pentagon, years ago. Mm-hmm. For proof of something going on in space, like a secret space program. That's my guess. In other words, he's misinterpreting the data that he has access to, and he's assuming that it's about aliens when it's actually not. This is the bucket I file in these STS videos and space station videos of things flying around in Earth's, upper atmosphere that shouldn't be there. I think we've been in space for a long time. And I'm not talking about NASA. I'm talking about the military industrial complex. I can't get the Wernher von Braun quote out of my head when I see stuff like this. And that, I don't even know, here we are in the Naked Bible Podcast talking about UFO stuff, but
yeah, it's a first.
Von Braun, of course, came
after
over
six
here.
After 6 years, we earned the right.
All right, we've earned the right. Von Braun came over here in Operation Paperclip. He was an SS officer and a Nazi and
head
of the U.S. rocketry program, host of Walt Disney's World of Tomorrow. I remember seeing him on TV as a kid. And the number three person at NASA, and he was in the SS, But, toward the end of his life, supposedly, von Braun became a Christian. There are these stories, but he had his personal secretary toward the end of his life was a woman named Carol Rosen, who's still alive. And sort of a deathbed confession on von Braun's part, he told her that basically, here's what's going to happen. Here's the plan. First it was the Russians, justifying, you know, military buildup. Think of the Cold War here. And next, it's going to be, you know, asteroids and meteors. You know, we need to, you know, have certain exotic weapons, you know, to fix that problem. And then it's going to be the climate, the environment. And last of all, von Braun said it's going to be aliens. And his famous quote is, "It's all a lie." Now, Carol Rosen believes that when von Braun said that, he meant to say that it's a lie that the aliens are bad guys. They're good guys and we shouldn't be shooting at them. But I think what von Braun meant is the whole thing. These are all cover justifications to weaponize space. A new Cold War in space. That's what I think is going on. And that's what I think the Israeli guy has stumbled onto or knows about and is misinterpreting it as aliens. So that's my take on it. I'm really not impressed with any of the tic-tac to the stars Academy stuff. I mean, there are still real journalists alive. I know that's hard to believe in this day and age. People who actually do investigate claims that people make. And if people are interested, they could go to just Google Tyler Rogoway, Rogoway. And he blogs and, you know, writes for a place called The War Zone. Just put his name into a search engine, Tic Tac, UFOs, TTSA, AATIP, and you're going to find some really interesting stuff. You're going to find patents on both our part and the Chinese for things that look awfully like the Tic Tac. And lots of other, you know, coincidental elements that may or may not be the real story behind all of this. But at least somebody's looking. At least somebody's asking the questions that need to be asked and isn't just buying the party line. So there are still a few people out there like that, you know, and again, that's my take on it. How that winds up on the Naked Bible podcast, I don't know, but
that's all right. Everybody knows we're in the paranormal, so it's all good. Do you see the new UFO documentary? That's
no, nothing's ringing a bell here.
Okay. Well, yeah, it just came out.
The first thing I will look at though is who produced it and who paid for it.
I think Jacques Vallée's on it too.
That used to be a good thing, but not so much anymore.
Well, I can't find it.
If they're doing Vallée, then basically we've made this movie to, I guess, make money, but we're not really going to discuss anything new because all this stuff's in print for like 30 years.
Well, Mike, why don't we turn our attention to the Bible?
To what we're supposed to be doing.
Right.
See, I know tactically what you're doing is you're trying to make people thankful that we're not talking about fantasy football. And it may have worked, so we can like do what we're supposed to do now.
Yeah.
And maybe people will go, well, UFOs was better than that fantasy football stuff.
Well, that's true. That is true. But unfortunately, the real reason why we don't talk about fantasy football, Mike, is because we didn't do good. We both missed the playoffs.
Yeah, neither of us made the playoffs.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's why we don't talk about it, is because I missed the playoffs by like 2 points twice. I'm so upset. I don't want to get into it. I'm trying to forget about it, Mike. So let's just move on to our question.
I hear you.
It's not a good subject right now, Mike. It's still hurts, still stings a little bit. All right. Well, why don't we get into these questions here? Yeah, I know. We got six of them here from some good people. And the first one, Mike, is going to be from Mike from Boston, who we've met. I remember going up there, 6 years ago, SBL, the conferences, and we did a live meetup. And Mike was there.
Yeah. So
that was fun. Long time ago. All right. Mike's question is, does Mike believe that the material he covers in Unseen Realm and Reverse and Hermon give more credence or viability for the Christus Victor theology stance versus the satisfaction theology stance? Which view, in his opinion, stays more in line with his understanding of the Second Temple Jewish era of thinking of the early church? If none, why?
Yeah, well, the last part of that, the Second Temple Jewish thinking and early church thinking are largely disparate. I mean, they do have some overlaps. You know, your Venn diagram does occur there. But, you know, if you're looking at both of those things, you know, there is no yes answer to that. You know, so which is more in line, because they both thought different things. So you know, you got to pick one, or at least one is close to the other. But more broadly, I'm not actually sure precisely what this question is about. It sounds like it's about the views of the atonement. Christus Victor theology, depending on what you're talking about. Is that the ransom theory? Is it something bigger than just the atonement? I don't know. I can't tell by virtue of the question. Satisfaction theology, does that refer to penal substitution atonement view? Again, I don't know. So basically, I just need more detail for the question. But for the sake of the episode, I'm going to assume that this is about atonement. So, you know, it looks to me like this is a question that gets into the same old debate about atonement views. I see all views of the atonement as contributing something to understanding the atonement. I feel no compulsion at all to pick one. It's just like, you know, why do I have to pick a view of the atonement when it's so multifaceted? It's like saying, it's like forcing me to pick one view of eschatology. It just makes no sense to pick one view. So typically, though, people want to land on a view of atonement that isn't penal substitution. Again, I'm presuming satisfaction is pointing to penal substitution. And they do that, frankly, to just avoid penal substitution because they have bought into the rhetoric, I think, of you know, not just militant atheism, but maybe they just feel icky that it's like human sacrifice. Okay, that is terribly wrongheaded. It's just terribly wrongheaded to look at it that way. But anyway, I'm operating on a series of assumptions here. This might be the farthest thing from the point of the question. I don't feel any need to avoid penal substitution. Substitution, you know, really can't be divorced from the atonement. But that isn't the only way to think about the atonement. I mean, all the other views contribute something. So if you're interested in this, and I am hitting the mark here, again, I'm just guessing here about atonement, I would recommend reading the short, it's actually really short, it's like 100 pages, but really good book by Simon Gaithercole, Defending Penal Substitution. It's excellent. Gaithercole is a seasoned New Testament scholar. Again, he's not going to argue that this is the only way to see things, but it is quite wrong to say that the atonement can and should be understood without penal substitution as an element.
Dorn wants to know about how might what Mary of Bethany in John 12, 1 through 7, and the sinner woman in Luke 7, 36 through 50 did with their hair relate to the idea in 1 Corinthians 11 that a woman's hair is essentially genitalia or a sexual organ.
Yeah, for listeners to whom this sounds utterly bizarre, I'm trying to remember the episode number now, but if you go to Google and put in nakedbiblepodcast.com and put in head covering, you're going to find an episode we did on 1 Corinthians 11 with the head covering. That's the broader context for this question. Now, getting to the question, I don't think these passages have anything to do with the idea that I talked about in 1 Corinthians 11. I also don't think the gospel writers would have had that idea in view in these passages at all. And the reason is simple. In 1 Corinthians 11, Paul is writing to Gentiles and is referencing Greco-Roman medical texts. In Greco-Roman medical texts, again, if people go back and listen to that episode on 1 Corinthians 11, and I do recommend not having kids around when you listen to that. In Greco-Roman medical texts, a woman's hair was viewed as part of, as an element of the fecundity process. You know, the longer your hair was, the more able, the more apt you are to get pregnant, because they believed that the hair, long hair, drew the semen up into the woman's womb, and then, you know, the results ensued. You know, she'd get pregnant. People like Hippocrates, which is a name we're familiar with even today, they wrote about this. This was their view. So I think Paul is referencing, and the point of the episode is that some of the vocabulary in 1 Corinthians 11, you know, can be looked at this way. I think what Paul is doing there to a Gentile audience is drawing on Greco-Roman medical texts and throwing that into the mix about his discussion of the parabolion, you know, the head covering again. And the point of what he's doing is modesty, you know, and again, there's this line about because of the angels, and we talk about how that harkens back to the Watcher story and the sexual transgression, you know, don't don't flaunt your sexuality, be modest, be loyal to your husband. This is what Paul's getting at, you know, and this is a vehicle by which to have that discussion. I don't think any of that is in view in these gospel passages because they're not writing to Gentiles. You know, this isn't the Jewish view. This is the Greco-Roman medical text view, a view, you know, common in among, you know, pagans, if you will, but, you know, Greco-Roman stuff. Now, you know, I think Paul, you know, having read that stuff and being familiar with it, you know, Paul seems to have adopted, you know, the same thinking, but there's no, you know, there's no vocabulary or there's no, there are no other clues in these other gospel passages that Jesus is, for instance, being solicited. You know, it's very evident in the context that he's not, they're repentant, you know, whoever these women are and so on and so forth. It, there's nothing like this going on in those passages. You know, the context of 1 Corinthians 11, especially to the Corinthian church, which is, they had just about every problem of, you know, sexual immorality that you can think of, is quite different than the gospel passages. So I don't think there's any reason, you know, any contextual or textual reason to look at these gospel passages in the way we would look at 1 Corinthians 11.
Tom has read a lot of commentary on the Beatitudes and wonder what your definitions of them are.
Yeah, I'm a little thrown off again by the wording here. I don't know what is meant by definition. You know, a beatitude is a modern label that extends from the phrase blessed is or blessed are. So it really doesn't have or need a definition. A beatitude is a saying that emerges from these passages in the Gospels where Jesus says blessed is, blessed are. I mean, that's uncontroversial. It just sort of is what it is. However, if the question is what they mean, you know, like what's the point of the Beatitudes, that would take a few episodes on the podcast to go through. So it's not something you can really, you know, address in a Q&A. I would say generally though, you know, the Beatitudes represent, and I'm getting this line from RT France, I believe this is where I read it, they represent the paradoxical values of the kingdom of God. It's kind of a good phrase, and you know, that sticks in the head. Basically, a citizen of the kingdom of God is going to look at life this way, and it's going to run quite contrary to, you know, expectations of people who are not citizens of the kingdom of God. Now, I'm going to open up France, his commentary. This is my favorite Matthew commentary, R.T. France's commentary. It's not that I agree with him on everything. I would disagree with him on, you know, certain things that we don't need to rabbit trail on here, but I really like the commentary. But to illustrate the point that if you're talking about the meaning, it's pretty complicated, and it would take up a few episodes to unpack this. So France writes these eight statements, and he has a footnote. Well, you know, some people say there's nine, some people say there's whatever. Okay. These eight statements are clearly designed as a coherent group. The epigrammatic form of the eight pronouncements, quote, happy or, you know, blessed in most translations, are those who, you know, dot, 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 ellipsis. It's a quality or an activity in the present tense. Happy are those who are doing whatever, for it is they who, and then there's a future verb, who will, there will be a result. So happy are those who are presently in this state or situation or mindset, and then there's something out in the future. He says that programmatic form is repeated each time in the Beatitudes with only very minor variation. The first and the last of the group both have the same second clause. So if you list the eight, the first one and the eighth one have the same second clause, which says, quote, for it is to them that the kingdom of heaven belongs, unquote. And France says this forms a framework which sets the tone for the promises which come in between. So the context for the Beatitudes is very obviously kingdom living, if you just want to put it that way. But you can see even from that, well, what does that mean? You know, is it, you know, and you got to keep the already but not yet thing in your mind here. That never goes away, by the way. It's just one of the fundamental points, the fundamental mindsets or things to keep in mind as you read the Bible to understand the thing. So I'm going to read a little bit more from France, you know, because he gets into you know, some background information. Again, I'm just trying to illustrate why this is complicated. Old Testament background to Matthew's Beatitudes. France writes, not only is the Beatitude form familiar from the Old Testament, which is a question nobody ever asked. Hey, does this sound like something in the Old Testament? Again, in this podcast, that's what you're looking for. France says, not only is the Beatitude form familiar from the Old Testament, especially the Psalms, but the content of these Beatitudes also echoes familiar Old Testament passages and themes. Isaiah 61, 1 through 3 tells of good news to the poor, reference to verse 3, and note that in Matthew, quote unquote, good news has already been defined in terms of the kingdom of heaven in Matthew 4, 23. So Isaiah 61, 1 through 3 tells of good news to the poor and of the comforting of those who mourn, Isaiah 61, 4. Verse 5 reproduces the Septuagint wording of Psalm 37, 11. Verse 8 reflects the pure in heart, he's in the Beatitudes now, who seek the face of God in Psalm 24, 3 through 6. More generally, the qualities commended echo closely the character of the righteous or the meek or the poor. And those two terms, or those terms, get used interchangeably. And these people, the meek or the poor, feature so largely in the Psalms and elsewhere as the true people of God, whom he will ultimately vindicate against the proud and the wicked who oppress them. Now, let me just break in here. The idea isn't if you don't have money, you're destined for heaven. The idea of the poor and the oppressed and the, you know, the poverty-stricken in Scripture is largely due to they have been done wrong by wicked leadership, you know, wicked governance, and ultimately the gods who govern the nations, okay, or the evil shepherds of Israel. So when you have unrighteousness done to you, God is on your side, because he doesn't like when unrighteousness is done to people. It's not that the gospel all of a sudden becomes, hey, you know, if you're poor, you're saved. No, that isn't the point at all. The point is that if you, you know, by virtue of something done to you unjustly, if you're in hardship or being oppressed, God sees that and he is on your side of that whole question. You know, and this is, you know, it's a character assessment. It's not about salvation or something like that. Anyway, back to France. He says, in other Beatitudes, while there may not be such direct verbal echoes, the teaching reflects that of the Old Testament, especially the Psalms again. For those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, look to Psalm 42, 1 to 2, Isaiah 55, 1 to 2. For the reciprocal principle of mercy to the merciful, look at Psalm 18, 25 through 26. For the peacemakers, there's Psalm 34, 14. However paradoxical these blessings may seem to those who view things from the world's point of view, the divine perspective of the kingdom of heaven has been well prepared for already in the psalmist's accounts of the qualities and experience of the true people of God. Note also that the comparable descriptions of those who may approach God's holy hill in Psalms 15 and Psalm 24, 3 through 6. So basically what he's saying is the Beatitudes have a lot of very clear Old Testament context and antecedents. France also, elsewhere in his commentary, talks about the eschatological character of the promises. So that's, we just talked about the already now. What about the not yet? Okay. Eschatology here a little bit. He writes, a distinctive feature of the Beatitudes and of those of Luke 6, 20 through 22 is that they not only list the qualities commended, but they also explain that commendation by a promise appropriate to each quality. The second half of each line is important as, and indeed is the basis for, the first. All but the first and last are expressed as promises for the future. And the question is often raised whether that future is envisaged as fulfilled within the earthly sphere, or whether it looks to compensation beyond this life. The third Beatitude, with its echo of Psalm 37:11, raises the issue particularly acutely, quote, inherit the earth, or perhaps the land, okay? Sounds more concrete than a purely heavenly reward. Let me just break in here. Yeah, unless we're talking about the New Eden, then it's both, okay? Back to France. So are these Beatitudes speaking of benefits now in this age and not only in the age to come? That is the language Jesus uses in Mark 10:30, but we shall note that Matthew 19:28-29 avoids such an explicit dichotomy and is worded in such a way that it can be read as speaking only of heavenly reward. So you're going to get both. On the other hand, the present tense used in verses 3b and 10b, it is to them that the kingdom of heaven belongs, present tense, warns against a purely futuristic interpretation and suggests that the simple dichotomy between now and then may miss the breadth of Matthew's conception of the blessings of the kingdom of heaven. The kingdom of heaven has already arrived for Matthew, Matthew 4:17. And so these are people who are already under God's beneficent rule. The advantages of being God's people can then be expected to accrue already in this life, even though the full consummation of their blessedness remains for the future. The tension between now and not yet, so familiar from much of the rest of the New Testament, thank you, Dr. France, may appropriately be seen as running also through the promises of Matthew 5:3 through 10. Again, this would make a good mini-series, you know, the Beatitudes, but as far as what they mean, there's no way to adequately even get into any of that in a Q&A. It requires a lengthy treatment. So if that's the intent of the question, we just have to wait till we, you know, get into these at some future point.
Our next question is from Asha, and she actually had a friend who is Muslim bring up these two questions. And one, the first one is, he believes that Muhammad is prophesied in Song of Songs. He said that the word beloved in Hebrew is Muhammad. He said that Christians are saying that these are different words. However, her question is, are the two words Muhammad in Arabic and beloved in Hebrew related linguistically? And second, she also said her friend asked her who is the prophet in John 1:21. He's implying that it is Muhammad.
Yeah. Well, just like there's Christian Middle Earth, where there's all sorts of wacky stuff said about the Bible, there's Islamic Middle Earth too, okay, where you get wacky stuff either said about the Quran or in an apologetic appeal with respect to Islam. I hate to put it this way, but I'm just going to be blunt. This is nonsense. You know, first, Arabic as a written language dates to a period well after the composition of the Song of Solomon or the Old Testament just generally. What used to be spoken and written was something that scholars call South Arabian. And South Arabian was contemporary with the biblical period, but classical Arabic, as in the Quran, dates to the Common Era, AD, if you will, or CE. The earliest argument, and this is sort of an extreme view of people within this linguistic inquiry, is that classical Arabic is as old as 100 BC, which is still much later than the Old Testament, centuries later. Yet, let's recall when the Quran was written. Okay, the 500s AD. Classical Arabic existed when the Quran, comes along, but it had not existed for very long. It's a literary language. And, there's no one-to-one correspondence here. There's also a semantic problem, though. So you have a language history problem. You have a semantic problem. The Hebrew for beloved, and all you got to do is look at this in a concordance or, a software or whatever, these passages is dod. The literary Arabic equivalent would be dad, which means foster father, or play, as in making a joke. So, no, it doesn't share the same meaning, and it certainly doesn't mean Muhammad, okay? And I doubt this person, Asha's Islamic friend, would want to say that Muhammad was a joke or something to be trifled, at, someone to be trifled with or at. So that you got a history problem in the language, you got a semantic problem. When it comes to John 1:21, we might as well just read that. John 1:21, let me scroll up here just a verse. I'll go up to verse 19. This is the testimony of John. Okay, this is John the Baptist. When the Jews sent priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, "Who are you?" He confessed and did not deny, but he confessed, "I am not the Christ." And here's verse 21. And they asked him, "Well, what then? Are you Elijah?" He said, "I am not." "Are you the prophet?" And he answered, "No." So the question is, you know, who is the prophet here? And again, the Asha suspects her friend is angling that this prophet is Muhammad. Well, wouldn't that make the question utter nonsense? Okay, because if John is writing 500 years before Muhammad is born, how would it refer to Muhammad? So that's one problem. It's also not worded as any prophecy, but it is tied into an Old Testament prophecy. And so maybe Asha's friend knows that there's prophecy in the picture here. And that it harkens back to Deuteronomy 18, verse 15. And this is the passage, you know, a prophet like unto Moses. All right. Here, I'm going to quote verses 15 through 18 because there's something in here that obviously is going to divorce this from Muhammad. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me. This is Moses again speaking to the people. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers. It is to him you shall listen, just as you desired of the Lord your God at Horeb, i.e. Sinai, on the day of the assembly, when you said, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God or see this great fire anymore, lest I die. And the Lord said to me, they are right in what they have spoken. Here's verse 18. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers. And I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all I command him. What's the significance of the prophet that God will raise up from among their brothers? This is spoken at Sinai. He's a Jew. Okay, the prophet that Deuteronomy looks forward to is a Jew. So that kind of rules Muhammad out. There are no Muslims in the Old Testament, obviously, because Muhammad isn't born until centuries after the close of the Old Testament period. And it's also centuries after the New Testament period as well. Now, immediately, of course, we know that Deuteronomy 18 is fulfilled with Joshua. Joshua, Yeshua. Where have I heard that? Oh, yeah. You know, this is the name, of course, of Jesus, Jesus, in the New Testament, and Jesus in the Septuagint. And those two things are designed, you know, to align with each other, both historically, literarily, and just, you know, to ring in the ear of anybody who's going to hear this, especially when Jesus starts preaching and it becomes known, you know, who this guy is. This has nothing to do with Muhammad. It's centuries, you know, irreconcilable. Muhammad wasn't a Jew. He's not from the tribes of Israel. I mean, it's utter nonsense. It makes no sense at all. So, no. Like I said, there's also Islamic Middle Earth along with Christian Middle Earth and just secular Middle Earth. Lots of crazy stuff on the internet that you'll run into that you can just safely ignore and disregard.
Our last question here is from Josh. And his question is, the parable of the tenants in Mark 12 is directed at the Jewish ruling class. But I'm wondering if there is also a connection to Psalm 82 and the corrupt Elohim over the nations. Thematically, the parable seems to connect. Corrupt lesser rulers who refuse to recognize the highest ruler and are judged.
Yeah, I don't believe this has any clear connection to Psalm 82 or the Deuteronomy 32 worldview. And there's sort of an obvious reason for this, but before I get to that, I mean, you know, if you look at the passage, there's no shared vocabulary between this passage, Mark 12, I'm talking about the Septuagint here, and the relevant Old Testament passages, you know, for Psalm 82 or Deuteronomy 32. For example, words like vineyard, you know, the Greek words behind vineyard and tenants, they don't pop up in relevant passages relevant to the Deuteronomy 32 worldview anyway. But the biggest problem is that the lesser rulers of Mark 12 are not Gentile powers or obviously the cosmic powers over Gentile nations. It's very clearly he's talking to the Jewish leadership. So that alone sort of disqualifies it. You know, it's a significant disconnection. Plus you don't have anything else to go on. Now, on the other hand, yeah, you know, thematically, this is about judging leadership. But again, it's leadership over God's people, i.e. Israel, in the gospel context. It's not leadership over the nations, but it's still judging corrupt leadership. So there's a conceptual analogy there between what Psalm 82 and what Mark 12 is talking about, but there's no textual or theological or even contextual relationship between the two, because one, again, the Deuteronomy 32 worldview is about the earthly and cosmic powers of the nations, and this is about, you know, Jewish leadership here.
All right, Mike, that's it for this week. That's all the questions we have for this episode. Well, that's it. We appreciate you answering our questions and everybody sending me your questions. Again, you can send those to treystrickland@gmail.com. And we appreciate it. And with that, I want to thank you everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.